Welcome to our podcast, Love Me Not, Domestic Violence in a Pandemic. This program represents the combined efforts of the Domestic Violence Outreach Team of St. Benedict Parish and Queen of Angels and St. Matthias Parish, both in Chicago, Illinois. What is domestic violence? Domestic violence can be defined as a pattern of behavior in any relationship that is used to gain or maintain power and control. Abuse is physical, sexual, emotional, economic, or psychological. It could be actions or threats of actions to influence another person. Domestic violence includes any behaviors that frighten, intimidate, terrorize, manipulate, hurt, humiliate, blame, injure, or wound someone within a close relationship, such as a spouse, a partner, a child, a parent, or a roommate. The statistics show what a serious issue domestic violence is in our world today. Every 9 seconds in the U.S., a woman is assaulted or beaten. As many as 1 in 3 victims of domestic violence are male. Around the world, at least 1 in every 3 women have been beaten, coerced into sex, or otherwise abused during her lifetime. Most often, the abuser is a member of her own family. Around 700,000 children are abused in the U.S. each year. Domestic violence is the leading cause of injury to women, more than car accidents, muggings, and rapes combined. Studies suggest that up to 10 million children witness some form of domestic violence annually. Nearly 1 in 5 teenage girls who have been in a relationship said that a boyfriend threatened violence or self-harm if presented with a breakup. Looking at U.S. statistics, more than 7 women in 10 and 3 men in 10 are murdered by their intimate partners. 78% of women and 22% of men have experienced stalking by former intimate partners. Incidents involving male victims have risen steadily in recent years. 92% of women surveyed listed reducing domestic violence and sexual assault as their top concern. And the list goes on. There is no excuse for domestic violence. Not stress, not joblessness, not frustration, not intense anger, not a partner's rude comments or bad behavior. There is no excuse. Yet domestic violence is real. It exists in every community, regardless of ethnicity, religion, income level, political affiliation, or educational level. Compassionate and expert support is available for people who have experienced all forms of domestic and intimate partner violence, crime, or abuse. As has happened with all such agencies, COVID-19 has impacted the various sources of support for survivors of domestic violence. Our speakers will explore the changes that COVID-19 may have brought, how each agency has adjusted to this new reality, and where survivors can find help. If you know of a family member who is experiencing domestic violence, you will also learn how you can help. We are delighted to begin our program with a presentation by Kate Lawler. Since February 2015, Kate Lawler has served as Swedish Covenant Health's Director of the Violence Prevention Program. As director, she has launched and developed a violence prevention program at Swedish Covenant Health that aims to strengthen the capacity of inpatient, emergency department, immediate care clinics, and outpatient practices to recognize and respond to patients who are impacted by domestic violence, human trafficking, and sexual assault. Kate currently serves on the Cook County State's Attorney's Office Sexual Assault Multidisciplinary Team Steering Committee and Advisory Group, as well as the Cook County Chicago Police Department District No. 20 Advisory Committee, the California-based Vesper Society Board of Directors, and many others. Prior to joining Swedish Covenant Hospital, Kate and her family lived for 8 years in Argentina, where she served as the regional representative for South America of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, ELCA. Her responsibilities included grants management and technical support in the areas of women's leadership development, health education, human trafficking, and domestic violence. Kate holds an undergraduate degree from Cornell University, master's degrees in public health and international affairs from Columbia University, and a master's degree in divinity from the United Lutheran Seminary. Kate is an Illinois certified domestic violence professional, ICDVP.
Hello, my name is Kate Lawler, and I am the director of the Violence Prevention Program at Swedish Hospital. I would like to thank the Domestic Violence Committee of St. Benedict Parish and Queen of Angels and St. Matthias Parish for hosting this podcast about domestic violence during the COVID-19 pandemic. The first question that I would like to address is, what adjustments has Swedish had to make to continue offering services to those experiencing domestic violence during the pandemic? At the beginning of the pandemic and during the surge of COVID cases and deaths in the spring of 2020, most of the advocacy services, both of our violence prevention program and our community partners in domestic violence, human trafficking, and sexual assault agencies, became remote. So we were talking with people over the phone rather than in person. So one example of this would be, let's say, a patient who's in a situation of domestic violence who comes into the emergency room. During that period in the spring, that person would be talking over the phone with a domestic violence advocate who was working from home. So that advocate would be doing safety planning and coordinating referrals to shelters, legal services, counseling, or other services that the person needs. By early June, as case counts started to go down and PPE is more widely available, the crisis intervention and advocacy services have moved back on site for in-person response in the hospital. Another example is, once the patient leaves the hospital, domestic violence services like counseling or legal services are still mostly being done by phone, and there is a lot of safety planning that goes into that because the survivor is often talking from home or from a place where there may not be a lot of privacy. So counselors and advocates have developed code words with the survivors that signal, for example, if it is not safe to talk right now, or if the survivor needs someone to call the police or get help in another way. So in general, I would say that as a field of domestic violence that has safety as one of its main objectives, COVID has given us new dimensions of safety to watch out for. So making sure that patients and staff are not exposed to COVID as we are interacting with each other, and taking into account the new precautions we need to take when talking with survivors over the phone, because there is a greater likelihood that the person who is doing harm may be close by. The next question that I would like to address is, what kinds of changes in domestic violence have you seen during the COVID-19 pandemic? So during the early months of the pandemic, we saw fewer cases, and I think that was because people were afraid to come into the hospital. In May and June, we really started to see the domestic violence cases increase, not only in number, but also in severity. Similar to other health issues, I think people maybe were waiting longer before they came in. So we see very acute cases of domestic violence, for example, that involve head injury and strangulation, which are indicators of very escalated violence. We are also seeing a significant number of cases that involve alcohol, which I see as an indicator of the stress that people are under right now and the use of alcohol as a coping mechanism. Other changes that we have seen in domestic violence during this time relate to how services have changed in the community. So I've already talked about how many of the advocacy and counseling services are now being done remotely. Domestic violence shelters have also had to put into place social distancing practices, which means that they cannot house as many people in one location. So it's important to know, though, that shelter is still available, and people who need shelter should call the Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline. And that number is 1-877-863-6338. You know, I think we often think about, when we think about domestic violence, we think about shelter. And we think about people in situations of domestic violence who are trying to leave those situations. And that is, of course, much of what we are working with and concerned about. There are also issues that people continue to face even after they have left the situation of harm. And so those situations often intersect with issues of immigration status, divorce, custody, and visitation. So those elements or components of domestic violence situations have become more complicated by court closings or delays due to physical distancing. And so people who need a decision to be made around one of those factors, for example, when someone's immigration process is linked to a person who is harming them, who is a U.S. citizen, there are federal programs that enable us to delink their immigration case for to delink the case from that U.S. citizen's case under the Violence Against Women Act. So, but those kind of procedures and processes are more difficult right now because there have been a lot of delays in immigration processing. And similarly with the divorce and custody and visitation decisions and, you know, court hearings that need to take place, people in many cases are just feeling like they're in a holding pattern before those decisions can continue to move forward. Orders of protection can still be obtained. Throughout this process, we have been able to help people get orders of protection. Sometimes that is done remotely. And the Domestic Violence Hotline is a good place to get information about how you can apply for an order of protection. So we wouldn't want anyone to think that that is no longer available, because that kind of misinformation can cut people off from services that continue to be available. They might just be available in a different way right now. The next question that I would like to address is, what steps can the community take to extend support to families who might be experiencing domestic violence? So, you know, we all know that a lot of families are currently separated from many of the in-person communities that might pick up on red flags or offer support for someone who's in a situation of domestic violence. So places like schools, places of worship and work. And therefore, it is more important that people are prepared to pick up on red flags and offer support in their closer circles. So, for example, with family, friends, neighbors. This is also a time when it's important to get information to people in discreet ways and in the places that they are still going to. So, for example, like grocery stores, pharmacies, food banks, information about domestic hotlines and services can be posted in those places, along with information about other social support. So if your church has anything in particular that they're wanting to offer to survivors of domestic violence, those kind of real local places that people are still going to would be good places to see if you can get that information posted. I know that faith communities are also really important hosts of the physical spaces for groups like Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon to meet. So I think that that support, you know, we need to make sure that that support continues to be available in whatever way it is safe for it to be extended. And, you know, because that support is more important now than ever, and we don't want people struggling with addiction to be feeling isolated at a time when they really need support. The last question that I want to address is, what support can family, friends, neighbors, and others offer when domestic violence is suspected? So what I would say here is that there are two important principles to any support that family, friends, or neighbors offer. So the first is that you don't want to do anything that makes the person who is doing harm feel that they are losing power and control. So some examples of this would be confronting that person. So it might make you feel better to confront the person, let's say your neighbor, and say, you know, I hear how you're talking to your partner, and I hear those threats that you're making, and I want you to know that that's not acceptable. And I'm going to call the police the next time I hear you talk like that to your partner. Or, you know, letting that person who's doing the harm know that you're aware of the situation. You know, this can put the survivor in greater danger because anything that threatens the abuser's sense of power can lead to them kind of tightening the controls. So they may not let the survivor talk with you anymore. If that person is your friend or a family member or even a neighbor, they might just really isolate that person even more because they see that they're starting to lose control by the survivor having communication with others. The second principle is to trust the survivor's own decisions about their safety and do not judge them for the decisions that they make. You know, that person is in survival mode, and that person is the only one who knows all the factors that go into their safety calculation. And while from the outside, you might be thinking, I don't understand why you're staying and you're making a bad choice by staying, it may actually be the safest option that they have right now, because an even greater threat is being made as to what will happen to them or to their kids or to other family members or people that they love if they try to leave. So it's really important to know that the most dangerous moment for a domestic violence survivor is that moment when they are trying to leave. And if they do not have a plan in place that has thought through all of the factors that might make that plan go awry, like if they forgot to get some, you know, critical medication that they have at home, that they can't go 3 days without that medication, they're going to have to go back, and the survivor will then maybe find the person that's harming them really angry because they went away for one night and now they have come back for the medication and they're going to be in greater danger. Or if they didn't think about all of the documents that they were going to need to be able to register their kids in a new school or to apply for a job. So those are safety planning measures that domestic violence organizations are expert in helping people think through all of those factors of a plan. And domestic violence organizations work with people, whether they continue to be in the situation where they are experiencing harm or whether they're no longer in that situation, that support is available to them. You know, it makes me really sad when I hear survivors say that they no longer have the support of their family or friends because those people lost patience with them for not leaving, because this plays right into the hands of the person who is doing the harm, because they may want this, they want the survivor to be isolated, because that way they have more power. So when we send messages to the survivor that are kind of like ultimatums, like if you don't leave, we can no longer interact with you because you're making a bad choice. That just really isolates them and makes them feel judged. And so the more that we can offer a support that trusts survivors and also understands that this is a process, and people need a lot of support to make decisions that are best for them, and they need people who are walking beside them and supporting them and believing in them in order to make those best choices.
Thank you so much, Kate. To repeat some information that's really important that Kate included in her talk, the number of the Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-877-863-6338.
In the next segment of our podcast, we're sharing a conversation between Mary Pat Dillon, member of our Domestic Violence Committee, and Officer Monique Giannone with the Domestic Violence Office in Chicago, and alumna of Queen of Angels School and Parish. Officer Giannone is part of the police response to domestic violence calls and shares important information about the city's processes, tools, and resources, as well as a realistic account of the challenges for survivors. As a note, you will hear reference to OEMC during their conversation, which refers to the Office of Emergency Management Chicago. The phone numbers provided by Officer Giannone are included in the description of this podcast.
Hello, my name is Mary Pat Dillon. I'm a member of Queen of Angels Catholic Parish in Chicago and a member of our Domestic Violence Committee. We're here this evening with Officer Giannone from the Chicago Police Department, the domestic violence officer for the 19th District. And she's going to answer some questions about her role and some items that we're curious about. First of all, Officer Giannini, do you want to explain to us what your role is?
So I am the 19th District domestic violence officer. I follow up with every victim. I pull every report. If the victim has either been, the event occurred in our district, or if they live in our district. So if you were a victim of domestic violence and you just happened to be in our district at the time it occurred, then I would follow up with you. And any resident that lives in our district, I follow up with them. So I cover domestic violence, child abuse cases, and criminal sexual assaults. And then I work with the detectives and other officers, depending on the situation, to try to get the victim help. So we're more victim-based, and then we can focus on the offender depending on the circumstances.
Okay. Since the pandemic has started, has there been an increase in calls to the police department?
In our district, we did not see a huge increase that were reported. So again, just because it's not reported doesn't mean there's an increase. We feel that there would be an increase in child abuse and domestics with the pandemic, but we were not seeing a huge increase, but there were a lot of my victims were able to relocate, so I was relieved to see a lot of them were able to go somewhere else for it, but there were some that were with the offender, and they got sick from, you know, the virus, and they were stuck in those situations, so, but I think overall they were concerned that the domestics increased.
Is there special training in how to handle domestic violence given to all police officers or just those assigned to deal with DV victims?
Everybody gets trained for certain aspects of it, but the DV officers have extensive training, and we're always getting trained on updated issues, strangulation, anything to look for, and then we try and go to our officers within each district and remind them of key things that help when we're trying to help a victim.
Where should a domestic violence victim call first in the middle of an abusive situation?
So we always want them to call 911 immediately as soon as things start so that they don't get hurt and so that if it escalates, we're already aware of what's going on. So it's always 911, never 311. It's always a 911 call.
If a victim is afraid that the offender will hear the call to the police department, is there another way for the victim to get in touch with the police department?
So right now, we don't have the ability for them to text 911. They would have to call 911. Now, if you were in the middle of a domestic and you called and I answered, I'm the call taker that answers at OEMC, if you hang up suddenly, then they do have the ability to text you, but initially you cannot text. You just have to call 911.
When that occurs, the police department calls, texts the victims, do you usually get a response?
It varies. Again, OEMC would be better able to answer that accuracy-wise, but I would imagine based on the circumstances, it would depend on their availability. If he's right there and he sees her on the phone, then maybe not. If she can get somewhere else, then yes. I know it's been successful in a lot of instances, but again, it's a kind of a touch and go situation, depends.
What is the first question that will be asked by the person who takes the call?
Okay, so I called OEMC and I talked to them. The first thing that a victim would be asked is, do you need an ambulance? If they say yes, then they'll be transferred to the fireside. They'll tell fire what they need, what the injuries are, and then they'll be transferred back to the police side. Then the dispatcher will continue to ask her a series of questions. Is the offender there? What's going on? Are there weapons? If the caller cannot speak and hangs up, then like that would be an instance where they would try to text him. There's also now the ability, and I'm not with OEMC, but they did tell me there's an ability to track the phone now. So if you said, you know, he has a gun, he just beat me up, or he just shot me or stabbed me, and then you hung up, now they have the ability to track the phone under certain circumstances.
Would the police automatically go out there then?
Yeah, then we would be dispatched immediately, but then say it was on the street this occurred, and then he relocates you. Now with this ability to track the phone, they would be able to then relocate, hopefully, her new whereabouts. That's the way it was explained to me, that this, you know, is a new feature that they have, that they're able to use. The other thing they do have, and we strongly encourage looking into it, is it's called Smart 911. So it's like a profile, and you could do it for anything, but for domestics, it's very helpful. So if you filled it out, you can say that this is your abuser, he does have weapons, he takes this medication, these are his triggers, whatever information, he usually beats me, you know, under my shirt, so that they know that if I come and I don't see anything on you, I know based on looking at your profile that you would have bruises underneath your clothing, because sometimes they target where they hit you or hurt you. So this Smart 911 is very good to look into, and people use it for pets. You know, if there's a fire, we have 3 pets. This is where they're kept, you know, etc. If you have a family member that has maybe some kind of disability or Alzheimer's, you could indicate that. This is their medication, this is what happens. And if you're not home, when we are going to the job, it would pop up for us. And then it, you know, it's not like we can save it. It goes away, but it gives us all the information before we get to the scene.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's a very useful tool if people use it.
If we ever had to go back to shelter in place restrictions, where would a person be able to go if they're under attack? I mean,
they can always go to whatever local police station, to the actual station, or if they go to anywhere that's safe. So if it was me and then I went to your house and I called 911 from there, then that would be, you know, the police would be responding to your house instead. But whatever is the safest and quickest for them is what we recommend. So you may not be able to go tonight, but tomorrow morning when he goes to work, you're able to come to the station and make the report. So then we would want you to do that.
Great. Many courthouses are now closed because of the pandemic. What can a person do if they need an order of protection order to be issued or extended?
So you can still go to 555 West Harrison to get an order of protection. It's normally a lengthy process, but it would really be a lengthy process. So you have to allow yourself the whole day. You fill out the paperwork, and then you will Zoom with the judge, and then the judge will grant you the order of protection depending on the circumstances. They also have put in place a DV helpline, and that number is 708-689-3422, and they will assist you with doing it online. So say that you're a high risk and you don't want to go to the courthouse because of the risk factor of COVID, then you can call that number. They will help you go through the steps to fill out the paperwork, and then they will give you a number, but you have to have access to Zoom when you do it, because then you have to Zoom with the judge. So You just, that would be the only criteria. If you do it with the DV helpline, you have to have access to Zoom, computer, phone, whatever.
If a person didn't really have Zoom on their computer and they weren't sure how to use it, you know, educationally, what would they be able to do, I wonder, to get on a Zoom?
That would be a hard one. Either find somebody that, maybe a family member or somebody mm-hmm. that they could go by their house. Because it takes a long time, it's not like, you know, if they came to the station. I did take a woman to court, though, and then she couldn't get it on her phone, so we did it on my phone. So then we just stayed in the car until she talked to the judge and waited. Because I took her to court, but then they said that they were doing the Zooms online, so we did it through there.
I wonder if the... if a person could go to the public library, because they have computers there that people can use.
That would be a question. They'd have to see if the Zoom feature was on mm-hmm. them. But yeah, I suppose so.
Okay. If an abusive situation is in progress when the police arrive at a home, is the abuser arrested?
So a lot of times they don't want the offender arrested. They just want them to leave. But if there's any indication of physical abuse, so if I see a bruise on you or I see a cut, then yes, he's going to get arrested, whether you want him to or not. But if, you know, you guys were just arguing and you don't want him arrested, you just want him to leave for the night, then no, we wouldn't make an arrest. So again, it's kind of dependent on the situation, but if I see any marks on you, then yes, now we are automatically, he's going to jail, or she.
Okay. Is it true that the rideshare businesses offer free transportation to people escaping abuse during a pandemic?
Initially, when this pandemic started, they were. I don't know that that's a current thing, because things have returned a little bit more to the way they were, so they would have to ask. I'm not sure. But again, if they left and went down the street and had their phone, they just have to call 911, and the officers would come out and assist them to where they need to go or to the station. So.
Okay. Are the shelters run by the city of Chicago? Are there shelters run by the city of Chicago? And do they take in large families, perhaps a mother and her children if necessary?
So we do have shelters throughout the city. They're run by different organizations, and they're run each a little differently. So if a family comes into the station and we call to get them placed into shelter, now they may not stay there. They might go to a different shelter depending on their needs. So it can vary. And once they're in the shelter, they have to abide by the shelter's rules and what the shelter requires for them to stay. So I know House of Good Shepherd is one that they try to then get the family back on their feet so that they can go be independent after they're with them. So each one's done differently.
Are there any shelters that allow the pets to come with the family?
You know what? I'm not sure. That is harder, but I'm not sure. Initially, I know when you're first getting placed for, like, the night, no. But I don't know longer term if there's any at all.
Okay. What do you see as the Chicago Police Department's greatest need in dealing with DV?
I think that the court system is challenging for victims sometimes because they've already been victimized, and it's a long process, and sometimes it's not easy for the victim to go through it. There's a lot of organizations that try to support the victim and help the victim through it, but just having to go back to court, you have to miss work, you have to find daycare. It's very challenging for some of the victims, you know, to go through the process. So I think if that could be a smoother process for the victims, that would be helpful. You know, they have to go back multiple times. It's hard for them. It is very hard for them. For DV, we have like a, it's called the Domestic Violence Hotline, and that's the hub for all DV info. So pretty much, if you have any questions, they recommend you calling the DV hotline. Instead of trying to call all these different resources, they try to put everything in one hub, so to say, and then you could pretty much get whatever help you need. So including like mental health, you know, you've been through a lot, you're traumatized, you know, we also want you to get that aspect of it taken care of, because just because you're physically out of harm's way doesn't mean that the emotional just goes away instantly. So the Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-877-863-6338. And then we also have every district has a domestic violence officer. So you could also call your district and ask to speak to that officer. If you're not sure, you could always call me. I'm with the 19th district, and our number is 312-744-8320.
Okay.
0064. 312-744-0064 is to our office, and you could ask for me, and then I will either get them where they need to go or help them with whatever they have going on.
Thank you so much. Well, what was the other number that you gave, a 708 number?
Yeah, so the DV helpline is for the order of protection.
Okay.
And that number was 708-689-3422. And they help you with the paperwork so that you don't have to go to 555 West Harrison. And then the domestic violence hotline number, which is the hub, and they kind of cover everything, is the 877-863-6338. And then the number to the police station where I work is 312-744-0064. Or they could ask for me, and then they'll be transferred to our office.
Okay, those are a lot of good resources. Thank you, and it's nice for victims to have a name.
Yes.
And to that's Officer Giannone. And I forgot to add at the beginning that Officer Giannone is a alumni of Queen of Angels Parish. Yeah. She went to Queen of Angels School, and it's so nice to have her here helping us out. And is there anything else you'd like to say, Officer?
No, just again, if any, you know, we want people staying safe. So as soon as you see something escalate, 911, or when you're safe, to give us a call and, you know, try to help you get in a safer place than you're in.
Okay, well, this was very informative. And I hope, you know, our listeners will have written these numbers down and have them handy if they need them. And again, we thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're so pleased to introduce our third and final presenter, Nancy Hawes, Director of Development from the House of Good Shepherd. After a long career in marketing and communications in the for-profit sector, Nancy felt a calling for nonprofit work and accepted a position as communications manager for a global health non-governmental organization, where she worked on-site with in-country programs in Central and South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and India. Working next in the Department of Development at the Mayo Clinic headquarters in Rochester, Minnesota, Nancy collaborated with key leadership to raise funds and awareness for Mayo Clinic's top strategic initiatives. 5 years later, she accepted a position at Valparaiso University in Indiana to work with the Department of Institutional Advancement. And of greatest significance, a headhunter contacted Nancy about the position at House of the Good Shepherd in the fall of 2014. Nancy believes that that position found her. Since moving to Chicago, she believes she has embarked on one of the most meaningful journeys of her life at the House of Good Shepherd. Nancy still believes her greatest achievement is raising her only daughter, Janine, who is currently completing her second master's degree.
Hello, it's good to be back. Thank you, Caroline, Rachel, and all of the wonderful members of the St. Ben's and Queen of Angels Domestic Violence Committee for giving me this opportunity to speak to you on behalf of the House of Good Shepherd in the age of COVID-19. We are grateful for your friendship, support, and your steadfast advocacy for women and children struggling to overcome the paralyzing trauma of domestic violence. We are all vulnerable, and COVID-19 has amplified the vulnerability of many individuals and communities already experiencing extreme poverty, homelessness, violence, isolation, and hunger, living without access to the most basic essentials needed to survive. House of the Good Shepherd is no stranger to meeting the needs of women and children during times of crisis, confusion, desperation, and anxiety-filled situations. Since 1859, we have served on the front lines throughout Chicagoland, caring for underprivileged women and children during disease outbreaks, a depression, 2 world wars, and 4 stock market crashes. Every single day, we are adapting to ever-changing demands and uncertainty. COVID-19 has shifted the way we do business. We have had to make revisions in our service delivery model with extra measures to keep residents safe and help them shelter in place with support and compassion. We follow all guidelines set forth by the Centers for Disease Control as well as those by the Department of Health and Human Services. For the past several years, we have shared our services with resident families at Madonna House, a homeless shelter located on the same campus as the House of Good Shepherd. On December 31st, 2019, the contract with the City of Chicago for the Madonna House homeless shelter ended. And on January 1st, 2020, we transitioned the Madonna House into emergency domestic violence apartments to serve up to an additional 14 families. Because the Madonna House is a communal emergency shelter, we had to temporarily shut it down since the outbreak. However, we continued to serve 20 clients that were unable to find safe place. During the last 6 months, our campus was quarantined for 2 weeks due to a family that tested positive for COVID-19. We were also recently closed for a few days because of protests, and we are still caring for 12 families in our transitional program who are all doing well. Those who had secured employment had to quit because we cannot risk them leaving and returning after exposure to other people. All counseling services are delivered through video conferences or phone. Adult education classes are conducted with no more than 3 to a room. The nice weather has given us opportunity to conduct art classes and other creative activities for our families while following safe distancing guidelines. We had to temporarily close down our child care center as per guidelines set by the Department of Health and the CDC. We recently reopened it with limited capacity in early July 2020. Our frontline staff is working staggered hours to meet all health care requirements with 3 days on and 4 days off to accommodate increased weekend demands. 40 of our aftercare moms who successfully exited over the past 2 years have recently been hit hard by this pandemic. We have opened up a food pantry on-site where they can stop by to pick up groceries, needed supplies, and gift cards to help them pay for the bare necessities. We had to restructure all of our programs to ensure social distancing at all times, as well as providing special safely distanced and sanitized workstations for online learning for all of our school-age children. Now I would like to focus on 6 specific questions that Caroline sent to me earlier. I will answer with a detailed overview for you now and encourage you to save any questions you have for me during our live question and answering chat following this recorded presentation. The first question: has your intake of residents increased since the pandemic? And if so, are you able to handle the influx or having to refer them elsewhere? Since the pandemic started, we have received about 20 to 25 more calls per month compared to pre-COVID. However, since mid-March to the beginning of July, we temporarily closed our intake because the pandemic posed health risks to the families already residing with us, as well as to our staff. During that period of time, we took names and a safe number to call back once our intake opened up. Question number two, are the incoming residents quarantined when they come during this time of pandemic? And what can she expect when she gets there? The incoming residents are quarantining for 10 to 14 days, depending on where they are coming from. If they are coming from another shelter, the quarantine is 14 days. If they are coming from their home, hotel, or another communal space, the quarantine is 10 days. During the quarantine period, staff pick up and safely dispose of all garbage, help with laundry, grocery shopping, to ensure that each family has all of their needs met. Once that period ends, the family can expect to fully integrate into our program. Do you have access and do you administer testing on incoming and or current residents? And if they prove to be positive, what is your protocol? We do not have access and we do not administer testing to any clients. For positive cases, we are following guidelines from the Center for Disease Control and the Illinois Department of Health. Individual families must self-quarantine and monitor symptoms for 14 days in their unit, and if symptoms worsen, they need to seek emergency help. Question number four, how is the House of the Good Shepherd protecting its residents from not just the violence and abuse at the hands of their partners, but from the spread of COVID-19? We have put practices in place, again following national and state health and human service guidelines to minimize the spread. Below are a few examples, and I really should say following are a few examples. Family safety. Masks must be worn at all times when families are outside of their unit. We take temperatures and conduct COVID screenings daily. We clean and sanitize all apartment surfaces and remove garbage daily. We bring empty sanitizer bottles to the lobby for daily refill. We defog all public areas weekly, such as the reception desk, entry and exit areas, hallways, and any gathering areas. During these defogging sessions, all families need to stay in their unit for 4 hours after cleaning. Residents are only allowed to use their personal bathroom. All public bathrooms on the site are closed. For our backyard and playgrounds and playrooms, there is a 7-day backyard and playroom schedule provided to families for playtime, as well as special arts, crafts, and yoga activities. Childcare and transportation for essentials. A schedule is made up weekly for weekly curbside pickup of groceries at Walmart. Two designated staff members provide transportation to doctor's appointments as well as to pharmacies. And two designated staff members provide all childcare services during this time. Childcare for counseling session. Two designated staff members are made available to watch children during telecounseling sessions. Case management and budgeting. Our case manager meets individually with each mom for their weekly appointment in the House of the Good Shepherd conference room. Question number five. What trends or patterns of abuse are you seeing in the nature of the abuse suffered by those who seek your shelter during the pandemic? Actually, the trends have not changed much. There is still the isolation, the financial abuse, physical abuse, manipulation, lack of access to resources, still remain the primary kinds of abuse related to family violence. The lockdown and stay-at-home orders do amplify the occurrence of domestic violence across our city. Question number six, what are the immediate needs of the shelter to handle the situation of the pandemic, and what long-term consequences do you see for your residents or for Catholic Charities' efforts to care for survivors of domestic violence? So far, we have been able to creatively figure out how to remotely serve many others by phone, as well as innovative telecounseling to care for our clients facing trauma, mobility restriction, illness, travel, childcare challenges, and transportation difficulties. However, the ongoing changes and ever-increasing demands will also incur significant costs not anticipated when our initial budgets were developed a year ago. For example, we face an increase in unexpected expenses related to staffing shortages, high demand for hand sanitizers and basic supplies for our clients, staff, and volunteers, as well as increasing client needs for financial, housing, transportation services, as well as completing unemployment forms and legal services. In response to these demands, Catholic Charities has had to step up efforts in order to sustain and expand the services we provide now and for the future. Catholic Charities will continue to provide nutritious food to keep the most vulnerable as healthy as possible. Across our food pantries, women, infant, and children, or WIC centers and senior centers, our staff is dispersing a record amount of groceries and to-go meals for the homeless and people who cannot afford food at this difficult time. We provide uninterrupted mental health and case management services to people coping with depression, trauma, as they navigate their sobriety. Home visits to the elderly who are more vulnerable, isolated, and frightened at this time with the help of our remarkable staff who are a godsend to so many. And our senior housing and domestic violence shelters are provided extra measures to keep residents safe and to help them shelter in place with support and compassion. As we navigate these uncertain waters, we want to reassure you that with you, your help, our emergency response to the value and dignity of human life for those individuals and families in greatest need is our top priority. I would like to close by sharing a number of short testimonials spoken by mothers who have successfully exited our shelter recovery programs, and another mom who arrived a few months ago, and you can hear firsthand what their experiences have been. I also want to leave you with a message that we are all called to be humbled before God and to be kind to our neighbor. Thank you and stay safe. Now for our messages from our residents.
It was really violence, and not only the main reason also that the violence was not only against me, but also against my son.
People that helped them with either their learning or social skills, or I feel like they're developing skills and more positive relationships with adults instead of seeing two people fighting all the time or seeing or having someone yell at them. These people don't yell at them, so it's a much better, more positive relationship.
And I have learned from the different domestic violence classes that they offer. It's very, very important, the classes, on what I thought I was doing right was totally wrong when it comes to raising children in a stable environment.
My kids, they was really doing well in school. My son, he was getting A's and B's. I was surprised that my daughter had passed the that's kindergarten, and she went to first grade. She was telling me, she was like, "Mommy, I'm going to first grade," and that's when I end up in tears.
The groups are great. The kids' groups are good. They love them. We have our own space. I can, make my own meals here, which is good. Because we actually came from somewhere before, a different shelter, and it was nothing like this.
From the people that work here, the volunteers that come here to help our families. It's a whole support system, you know, that the classes probably in tandem with everything, you know. So it's not, I don't think it's one particular thing in my experience. I'm just feel very, very fortunate from the people that work here, the volunteers that come here to help our families. It's a whole support system, you know, that the classes probably in tandem with everything, you know. So it's not, I don't think it's one particular thing in my experience. I'm just feel very, very fortunate.